Today's episode of A Novel Podcast is sponsored by Audible, and several of the books we're discussing today are available on audible.com, as well as thousands of other titles. A Novel Podcast listeners can get a free trial of the Audible service by going to audibletrial.com/anovelpodcast. You're listening to A Novel Podcast, in-depth discussions of literature from all genres and generations. I'm your host, Russell. I'm joined by my wife, Sarah, and our good friends, Daniel and Aaron. Today we're discussing The Devil in the White City by Eric Larson. This book, written in 2003, tells the story of the 1983 Chicago's World's Fair and the notorious serial killer H.H. Holmes, who used the tumult and the popularity of the fair to mask his nefarious agenda. Now, I found this style of writing to be very approachable. It read just like a novel, with perhaps some more detail on the architecture and the politics behind the fair that I would have expected. I'd like to start by reading a quote from the book. Now, this quote coming from pretty early on when the Chicago residents were kind of arguing over how the fair should be produced. And the quote is, "Olmsted was no literary artist. Sentences wandered through the report like morning glory to the pickets of a fence." Now, I found this quote to be evidence of the brilliant dichotomy of the novel itself. Death and murders are gruesome, the landscaping is brilliant and beautiful, and the lengthy details about the architecture and the engineering really showcase the deliberate planning that went into the exposition. It's almost as if the novel itself were a metaphor for the history and the events it recreates. So, Sarah, what did you think?
I really liked the novel. I didn't exactly know what to expect going in. It had been recommended by several people. I wasn't anticipating the chapter-on-chapter-off format. But I liked it a lot. I felt like the architectural elements in the beginning half were a little dry. Like, I struggled a bit to get through. Like, he talked about Olmsted's upbringing and Burnham and Sullivan and exactly how they came together and what their partnership was like. And I felt like that was a little dry. I wanted to get into the killing. Because I'm, pretty classy like that. And like true crime. But after we got to, the fair actually being built, I felt the architectural element really picked up. And the book sort of converged together well.
Mm-hmm. I love the scene where the reporter is at the fair the day before it's supposed to open. And he says, "My God, this isn't ready. How are they going to make it work?" And then somehow, miraculously, they pull it all together the morning of. Daniel, what did you think?
I thought first off, I thought it was a great book. It was dense, but you couldn't put it down, which is odd enough for me, especially in a historical book, considering how mundane or how monotonous or how dry they can usually be. Because I think there's a stigma that comes with a historical novel in any form, just as people, we think that it's going to be dense or thick. And this is a really short read, especially you described the chapter on, chapter off format. That really helped it in me to switch between characters and then events, and even make the events a character in themselves.
Yeah, I would say that the city was almost a character in the book by the end. Mm-hmm. You saw it coming together, sort of being conceptualized and developed and then born into what it was.
Okay, so you're talking about the exposition, not Chicago?
Correct. Mm. Correct. Although I guess Chicago was a bit of a character in the beginning. They had the rivalry between Chicago and New York, competing to find out who would host the fair.
Mm-hmm. I like the quote. They said Chicago was thrown in there almost as an afterthought. Nobody thought St. Louis was going to make it.
Yeah, well, the fact is that it opens up a period of history people think we know, and it expands upon that. Like I remember thinking I knew sort of what the World's Fair was,
right?
But what it does so well is it expands upon just the history of it. Mm-hmm. And again, this is a historical novel, so that comes with the territory. But there's a way in which the author just uses his own personal opinions and his writing skill in this sort of pseudo-deductive manner to make you want to read on. Mm-hmm. And again, I'd still argue that the city, the White City, or even the World's Fair become two characters in themselves because of everyone's involvement in them.
Yeah, I agree.
I'd even say, in spoiler alert, that Holmes's hotel, because we learn about the history of that as well, becomes a character. Almost like his pseudo henchman, like his minion, or a pseudo antagonist to him. Because it's just as insidious as the man they describe in it. As his real name is something Mudgett.
Yes.
Herman Webster, right. Mudgett.
Mm-hmm.
Which, this is a little tangent, there's something crazy about that, in that one of H.H. Holmes' descendants found out who he was related to and has gone on, he has a website, I'm not sure what it is called, but he has gone on to claim that Mudgett was really Jack the Ripper, and vice versa.
I saw that. It made headlines like the day after I finished the book.
Yeah, and there's some striking evidence for it, but then it's too coincidental.
Yeah.
That sounds like a crazy fan theory.
It almost is in the way he presents it.
Because also, coincidentally, I believe he wrote a book at the same time.
Mm.
So, you know, like, oh, hey.
Interesting.
Also, I wrote a book about this theory I have, so. Yeah.
He's going to be on Investigation Discovery pretty soon.
You'll see. I think he had
You'll
a whole
see
thing.
It in those slow motion dollies, and it's going to be a dark background. You see him with his arms crossed, and he goes, "My great great grandfather was something Mudgett. You may know him as H.H. Holmes."
America's first serial killer. And then there'll be like dramatic music, and yeah, I can see this.
It's really conspiracy theory esque, though, in my opinion. So. Don't listen to him. Go read The Devil in the White City. Read this book.
It's one of the better books I've read recently, I think. And we read some good stuff.
Yeah, it is. It sort of made my skin crawl.
There were creepy elements, for sure.
Especially in the accuracy of which, there's no doubt about it that H.H. Holmes, other than being a serial killer, psychologically today he'd probably be described as a sociopath.
Yeah.
Or a psychopath. And the way in which, even as a child, as we get a bit of his history, it's disturbingly accurate and clear-eyed portrait of what it's like to see somebody not care for other living things.
Hmm.
Well, throughout the book, how many marriages did he have? Three or four marriages,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, and the way he described, you know, when he comes to Chicago was really interesting to me, because he describes it in this way of saying it's as if a lizard looks at something that it doesn't understand. Or it's something those lines is it's a reptilian human being. As if like our skin is just a shell from which they can plot.
Right.
Very disturbing. It made my skin crawl. It was very creepy.
Oh, I'm looking at my notes from early in the book, and I have a note that Holmes was quoted as being very good with babies.
Mm-hmm.
What's the matter with these people? He's obviously super creepy. Probably don't leave your baby with him.
Well, what's fascinating about Holmes is the way he is both very charming, but at the same time extremely sinister. I mean, he's able to, the creditors that come to take back the things that he's borrowed on credit, he's able to charm them and become friends with them, but then at the same time he's building this, you know, torturous hotel.
Right.
Holmes himself, it could be a metaphor for the novel, or the novel perhaps for him, in that you've got this really positive, gleaming white city, but then malignant undertones at the same time.
Well, even when they talked about the city,
mm-hmm.
it sort of was slowly sinking, and then immediately after the fair ended, it basically fell into disrepair and decay, and
mm-hmm.
became a squatter's village, and... Mm-hmm. But they burned it down, I believe, right?
Mm-hmm.
Was the final resting place of this. Right. So I thought Larson just did a really good job of showing the juxtaposition between Holmes being charming and, like, he seemed like quite the ladies' man. The entire novel was him courting and marrying and impregnating, like, it seemed like dozens of young women.
Mm-hmm.
And the point was, and the other point is, they were from all walks of life, from what I remember.
Yeah, mm-hmm. for the most part.
And he had no pattern. You know, you think if he had a goal in mind, he'd marry for money.
Yeah, he was pretty laissez-faire, like blasé about who he chose and who he murdered. And, I mean, for the most part, it was females, but...
In the South, there's another saying for that.
Oh, yeah?
We just call him a horn dog.
All right. We'll take that.
Or he, you know, he. I don't know the down home term for it, but I know there is one. It's the South. We have something for everything. We have a shady nickname for everybody.
So let me ask you a question about Holmes himself. Is where do you think his power over his victims? Where did his charm come from?
Manipulation.
Yeah, it's manipulation. But it seemed like he didn't really have a home life where you would think that would be like cultivated or fostered.
Mm-hmm. But the point is you think about it, if he has no inner being, if he has no reflection from childhood to build up who he is, then he's probably just mirroring the people he's charming.
That's my guess.
Could be.
I mean, what did they call it? What's the saying? Impersonation is the greatest form of flattery or something like
mm-hmm,
that.
Mm-hmm.
I think in my mind, I think he was just mirroring the people that he was charming. There was, if you ever watch or read anything on Ted Bundy, his final trial, he represented himself.
Right.
For those who don't know, Ted Bundy was a massive serial killer back in the 80s. In fact, my hometown, he was captured in.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. After he escaped, we pulled him over. A local traffic cop pulled him over for having a busted taillight.
I remember hearing that story.
The police didn't know who he was until until the press showed up, to be honest. and the way, anyway, going back to his final trial, he represented himself.
Hmm.
And the thing was, is the judge, after sentencing him, giving him his sentencing, said he would make a wonderful lawyer. So the crazy part is,
boy,
for me,
if you
going,
hadn't done it, you'd have done well with this.
That's basically what he said. It went along the lines of, I would have loved to have seen you practice in front of me. I thought you would have made a good lawyer, but you went down the wrong path, son. And the funny part about that is how you can rate that back to H.H. Holmes. If you think about it, he probably would have been a fantastic architect.
Yeah.
In the way he designed the hotel and how he fired crews and hired new crews every other week.
Well, I think one of the fascinating elements of Holmes' character is way back when he was still living in New Hampshire, he cooked up the first insurance scheme. Basically, he took out an insurance policy on someone and then produced a dead body and said, oh yeah, that's him. And it said he collected $40,000, which was over $1 million in today money, in a life insurance scheme, before he even started murdering. And then they speculate that he did murder people after that. But I think what's really fascinating about Holmes is what was his motivation? It wasn't for money. And you're talking about how he hired these crews and fired them before he had to pay for them, and like the debtors would come and try to collect, repossess his things. From Larson's account, it seems like he was wealthy.
Yeah.
Don't we really get a good glimpse into his motives towards the end of the book?
Do we?
I'm pretty sure we do. Because, not to get ahead of us, but I think, if I recall correctly, Larson pretty much lays it out for us in that I can't recall the name of the detective who was chasing after him while he was going for Benjamin Pitetzel's kids.
Right.
Right. If I'm getting all these names right, if I'm getting them wrong, forgive me.
Pitetzel, yeah, you got him.
But so he's got Pitetzel's kids, and he's moving them around, making them stay in various hotels, moving from city to city. And at some point in time, the detective realizes that they were a couple of blocks from each other, the mother and the children, and they had no idea they were in the same city.
So what I didn't realize when I was reading the book, but I listened to last podcast on the left, they had an H.H. Holmes suite.
Mm-hmm.
He was not only moving the mother and the children, he was also moving his mistress around.
Mm-hmm.
And it was part of the game for him.
That's it.
He would take all three to the same city and book them in hotels that were several blocks apart.
It was a game. That was his motivation.
Yeah, but
he just wanted to play a game. So like Jigsaw.
Isn't that insane? That's absolutely insane.
Aaron, you've been awfully quiet. Do you have any input, any thoughts on this? Hey, did you enjoy the book?
Oh, well, I had to remember what was in it. It's been so long. I think I was just thinking about it. This book, I used to hate history, and I took a big gamble on this book because I was like, oh, there's, you know, a lot of history in this book. I don't think I'm going to like it. And it's true. It was really hard to put down. In fact, towards the end of the book, and even at the end, I was like getting chills because it took that long for me to actually remember who most of the people were in the book, because they're real life, you know, people. And I was like, oh my goodness, the transition they make at the turn of the century is pretty neat, and how that comes about. And later, I actually had made a trip to Chicago and was trying to find all these landmarks shortly after I had read the book. And I was like, oh, you know, I think this was over here, and I think this was over here, and I was so excited. You know, I think I forgot a lot of the story, but it was, the part that I liked the most was when they were the World's Fair. The killing stuff, I was like, okay, whatever. I was fascinated by the craziness that went into trying to put on this big event, and that's probably what I liked the most about it.
Yeah, I'd actually concur with you, Aaron. I preferred the architecture and the World's Fair part of it, but I think the Holmes factor makes that great dichotomy to it. Interestingly enough, my favorite part of the Holmes story is him building that hotel.
His
castle.
Yeah.
I think about how, and you mentioned his tactics in how he can get away with not paying people. Part of that was, of course, making sure that no one really knew the layout of the hotel. People would install a gas pipe, but they wouldn't see where it would go to.
Right.
People would build the room and not see that there's a gas pipe leading up to it. And well, probably one of my favorite scenes in the entire book, at least as far as the creep factor goes, is when he invites his potential mother-in-law to tour the hotel and says, oh, I need you to do me a favor. Would you please go in there and scream as loud as you can? I want to hear if the soundproofing actually worked.
How creepy was this guy?
I had to say that part did make me laugh.
Yeah.
It does show the naiveness of the 20th century, the early 20th century.
Yeah, late 19th?
Late 19th, early 20th, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and that's one of the reasons you brought up the insurance scam, too, is that the body was missing parts of it, right?
I think so.
Mm-hmm.
And no one, there was no kind of checks and balances system. People were like, well, I guess he's just honest about it.
Right. Well, he has those pretty blue eyes. He's probably telling the truth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, everybody sort of assumed that the best nature was in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was just one of those things. I shouldn't have laughed at it, but I thought it was really funny that she was willing to just go along with it, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, go ahead and lock me in this vault, and I'll scream as loud as I can, and we'll see what happens. Was that a mother-in-law, or was that the...
I don't remember precisely who
Larson
it was,
speculated but... that, was it, I think Minnie Williams was one of his final love interests? I don't know.
Mm.
Victims would be an accurate portrayal.
Romantic victims?
Romantic interests. But I think that's what he did with her sister, right?
The sister came out and
was sort of sniffing around, like, Minnie, this guy's pretty shady. Also, no one has ever liked you before, so...
Yeah.
He's probably creepy. And Holmes charms her and then locks her in a vault and suffocates her.
So I was trying to do another little tangent. Was part of the book, obviously it deals with the creation of this one period of time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is a moment in history. The kind of interesting thing for me was, since Holmes, it's about buildings and architects.
Right.
Granted, one of them's a serial killer. But it's kind of fascinating how Larson linked the two together. And it was almost to me, when the idea maybe came from him looking at it as if three people who wanted to build great things in their mind that would last forever, or last as long as they could, sustain themselves.
Mm.
And then it turned out one of them was a serial killer and the other two were helping the World's Fair in Chicago. Now, I may be totally off the mark here, but...
Would Patrick Eugene Prendergast fit into that?
Yeah,
I would say so.
I mean, could you have the two upstanding and the two nefarious side by side?
Well, I think you could, but I don't think Prendergast quite is an accurate reflection, because he seemed more like the henchman. Like, Holmes had finesse, and Holmes had charm, and Holmes... was good at this, he just needed someone to do the dirty work, and that's where, from my reading, it seemed like Prendergast sort of came in there. He was there to literally, like, haul the chest down the stairs.
I think you're thinking of Pititzel.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm referring to Prendergast, the guy who was the political activist and thought he was...
Oh, right.
Thought he was Mayor Carter Harrison's best friend. showed up for the job.
Right. Right. Oh, yeah.
And didn't get it.
Yeah, that guy.
I'm sorry. It's almost like, and this is demented, but it's almost like a demented comedy of errors, too.
Mm-hmm. Sort of.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like this nonfiction book rivaled some good fiction that I've read in the past.
Truth is
stranger than fiction. Well, the interesting thing is
yeah.
obviously with a book of this magnitude and this, what would you say, importance, or the characters are historically significant.
It definitely has some gravitas to it. Yeah.
There's always been talk of adaptations for mm-hmm. it in film. The latest, and I was looking this up after I finished reading it, the DiCaprio, purchased the rights to the book in 2010, obviously to play H.H. Holmes.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Especially given how evil he can be since we've seen him in Django Unchained.
Mm-hmm.
Which is another demented character you could do hours of talk with. But it's been floating around, so it's been 7 years since he bought the rights to the book. It's gone through several different studios that have sat on it, and they haven't done anything with it. Recently, it said that Billy Ray, who was the writer of Captain Phillips and The Hunger Games and State of Play and all these big political movies pseudo-historic movies,
mm-hmm.
was going to write it, and Scorsese was at the director's chair. So, and reportedly, this is going to be his next movie after The Irishman.
Mm-hmm.
But there's talk of it not being a movie and it becoming a miniseries for HBO, which I think would work far better at the end.
I think that the format that it was written in, anyway,
mm-hmm.
I think it would be tough to get this into a 3-hour feature.
Yeah.
Exactly. You'd think just the length, it'd be close to 3.5.
I would think.
Yeah, but you could do some great stuff with, cliffhanger ending, episode endings. And,
oh, yeah.
And it just, ever since Battlestar Galactica and all these other, you know, the more mature television series we've been watching the last 10 or 15 years, Game of Thrones, Lost, you get the multiple storylines happening at the same time, bouncing back and forth between the two of them. Yeah, mm-hmm. You could do really well mm-hmm. with that. And one of the questions I was wondering is of course, Leonardo DiCaprio purchasing the rights, the making of a movie could be inevitable. How would you turn this into a movie?
Oh, you'd have to exercise, I do believe, Prendergast and Harrison.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You couldn't have that in a movie.
No, definitely not.
In fact, you know, the only other movie I can think of, it's a movie from the 80s called Ragtime.
Mm-hmm.
Which is based on the book by E.L. Doctorow.
Which there was a musical right?
Right.
Which is one of my favorite musicals.
And this is not a musical.
No. But.
In fact, Ragtime is such a big book
and
about so many people that they only focused on one guy.
Mm.
Oh, really?
And that's a 2-hour and 30
who
minute.
Who did they focus on in the movie? This is a total tangent.
The black piano player who holds the library hostage.
Cole House Walker.
Right. Right, right. And they focus on him and more or less the other main characters become subplots. But Cole House Walker is the main character of Ragtime, the movie. And it was directed by Milos Forman, who did One Flew of the Cuckoo's Nest and Amadeus.
Mm-hmm.
And even he said trying to adapt this today, back in the 80s, was difficult because you're taking a book with at least 5 main characters.
Well, yeah, even
and distilling some kind of essence into a theme or a character piece.
Well, the characters sort of rise and fade really nicely too. Larson really did a great job with this subject matter, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I have another of his on the table ready to go as soon as I
is it well good.
I tried another one, too. It's about the Lusitania.
Yeah, I think that's the one I have.
That was the other one recommended
to
me.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I did get the one, and it's kind of crazy how each one mirrors each other, all his books. He has this really great writing style, which is interesting. I mentioned earlier historical novels being kind of dry, and David McCullough, who has done his entire career, is just based on basically biographies of famous people, mm-hmm. famous American figures. In fact, Truman by McCullough is looking at me right now on my bookshelf. And I'm reading this right now on the Larson, and he cites McCullough as one of his literary inspirations.
Oh, neat.
But I think Larson has a stronger command of novelistic tendency and how to engage the reader, whereas McCullough has a very dry, upfront, matter-of-fact writing style.
Well, like Aaron, you were saying, you generally shy away from historical reading, and I'm with you. I like historical fiction a lot, and I try to read historical novels or historical nonfiction. It's just a little dry sometimes, but I think Larson just did a really good job of painting the characters well. Even, I'm looking through my notes here, and even, like, I forgot about Ferris.
Mm.
And, you know, he casually mentions, like, oh, well, there was this young upstart from Pittsburgh in the meeting, and he doesn't say who it is. And the whole time I'm reading, I'm like, well, who's this guy? Like, I'm from Pittsburgh? Who is this? And then eventually you find out the reason he didn't name drop is because it's Ferris, and you would obviously know why he was there.
Yeah, it was definitely not dry. And if I remember correctly, some books transition so quickly, I don't remember what characters I'm on. And this had two pretty solid storylines that I knew when I was in the next chapter that I was on a different storyline. And I could remember what happened before we transitioned. So that was pretty nice.
Yeah. Yeah, he did a really good job of, even as the character sort of came into the narrative and faded away, I didn't feel lost at any point in time. Like, early on, we had, you know, the two architects. We had Burnham and Sullivan, and Sullivan passed away before the fair was even completed, but we had that full portrait of Sullivan. And then later, as I read, it seemed more poignant, and I understood a little more why he went into such depth before really launching into Holmes and the fair and exactly what was happening. So even I think though, this is the subject matter could be a little dry, I think he did a really fantastic job of bringing it all together.
Yeah, and I think that you can actually, when you were reading it too, you could visualize things that you'd never seen before.
Right.
Just by the way that he had written it.
Now, one thing that I did not do any due diligence on is the factual accuracy of the stories. I mean, do we have any idea, have we read any reports on any embellishment that he may have thrown in for artistic effect, for dramatic effect?
It's been a while, but I think there are a few things.
I think there were a few things. I think there were a few things with the detective in the end. Geyer?
Mm-hmm.
G-E-Y-E-R. Geyer, yeah, I'm guessing. Geyer. I think that some of that was a bit embellished, and I think the timeline was a little off of exactly how things actually happened.
Okay.
But I think for the most part, from what I've seen factually, it was pretty accurate.
Mm-hmm. I certainly didn't see anybody screaming about how inaccurate it was.
And you know we like to do that.
Humanity? Americans?
Yeah, interneters?
Yeah.
Tweeters?
Yeah.
Right.
So if I could take us back and let's talk about the exposition a little bit more. The thing that I found most fascinating about this personally is I'm a huge fan of amusement parks in general and some of the nicer, more named parks a little bit more. And watching the way that this city was built, from me not understanding at all what was coming, I knew no history of this whatsoever. But watching the way that the city was built and seeing and recognizing certain things, you know, lunch counters and things like that, and then moving on to find out that Elias Disney had worked at the World's Fair as a carpenter, and then, of course, years later told his son Walt all about it, it intrigues me to see how much this just little exposition was an influence upon modern architecture, but then more than just that, also entertainment. You know, what did you guys think of that? You pick up on little things here and there that intrigued you?
That was my favorite too. That and Annie Oakley. Yeah. And who was the other?
Wild Bill.
It was where they mentioned how the Wild West faded away and transitioned. Yeah, that ending was, that area of the book was definitely my favorite part.
Yeah, that they said, like, the little things like that. They said they had belly dancers there, and it was where the
yes.
Like, someone just wrote that, and now, like, literally everyone knows that song.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone, and you associate it with belly dancers, and it's all because, and it was one of the main characters, right? Just threw it in as a background music for these belly dancers mm-hmm. they had. I made a list of the firsts that occurred at the fair.
Mm-hmm.
So the first mm-hmm. live music transmitted by telephone, the kinetoscope, so moving pictures, Tesla with lightning was there, the first zipper.
Yeah.
Like, how crazy is that?
Mm-hmm.
An all-electric kitchen, including a dishwasher, Aunt Jemima's pancake mix.
Mm-hmm.
I was really excited about that. And Juicy Fruit what? Gum.
Pabst Blue Ribbon.
Yeah, PBR.
What?
Cream of wheat.
Shredded wheat, I had.
Cream of wheat and shredded wheat.
Cream of wheat and shredded wheat. Cracker Jacks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like, that's crazy.
Electric lights.
Yeah. It makes me wish I was alive at that time. There's mm-hmm. nothing like that anymore.
I do have a list. I'm assuming when I die and go to the afterlife, I'm going to be able to fly around and visit places in the past. Maybe just ethereal, or maybe I can take over people's bodies. And after reading this book, the World's Fair, the Columbian Exposition, is on that list.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was so excited. So one of the things I did while I was reading this is I do like true crime. I made a point to not do any external research. I wanted to finish the book before I really started looking up Holmes outside of this novelization or the World's Fair. And I got so excited because I thought, oh my God, these buildings have to still be there. We have to plan a trip to Chicago. Like, this is going to be great. We're going to go see the exposition hall, and we're going to see the women's building. And then I found out it all burned down, and I had a moment.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. I can confirm that it is not there. In fact, I was literally trying to figure out what direction I should be pointing to imagine where it had been.
Right, I think we could go see some graves.
I was so excited. And I was like, why wouldn't you hold on to any of this stuff? It's crazy.
It is rather amazing, and I think that's part of the thing that kind of turned into Disneyland and other modern amusement parks, is that they go to all this trouble to have this thing open for just barely long enough to turn a profit.
Yeah.
And if they just kept it open for another 6 months, it would have been a nice business.
That's true. I was there was you mentioned about little details of the fair. They said after the fair, I didn't write it down, I don't think, but that specific architecture style became the norm.
Mm.
Like, that's why our courthouses look the way they look.
Mm-hmm.
That's why they're painted white. That's why there was something else. The columns on courthouses and like window balconies or something were popular. And it's all because of the fair.
But the book itself is dotted with those moments.
Yes.
Where you go, oh my goodness, of course. That's amazing. Throughout every part of that half of the book, at least. I feel like every chapter or two, I'm come up with some kind of a gee whiz moment or a aha. Now, one character we haven't mentioned at all was Olmsted. And of course, Olmsted was landscape planner.
Yes, the landscape architect.
Complete workaholic. And fascinating Olmsted, he designed, we live right outside of Washington, D.C. And so he's designed a number of buildings that I've been in since I was a wee lad. In fact, if you go to the National Zoo, the main walking path through the National Zoo is the Olmsted Walk, because he designed a good portion of the National Zoo.
Which, until we read this book, like, we talk about going on the Olmsted Walk,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't even know who he was.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
Real-life connections.
But what I'm curious about is, from his perspective, would you agree with his plan? You know, modern amusement parks, do they share his design, or is his design of a more organic and a kind of a messy feel, is that actually superior to something that could just be a little more trite and contrived and Art Deco-ish?
I think you can see Olmsted's influence in, like, we've mentioned Disney,
mm-hmm.
but that's one of the places when I think of landscape architecture really coming into play.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are elements of the park that are entirely dependent on what's planted where.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I think his influence can be seen in modern day.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not like Six Flags, but okay, definitely.
Maybe snippets of it here and there.
Maybe other
Idlewild.
But as far as those amusement parks go, and even, you know, your annual carnival at the fair, Olmsted at one point in time was walking through his garden, and he went, well, this people are just kind of passing through here. They're not enthralled with it. We need to bring interest in. We need to have the pygmies walking through. Yeah. We need to have a juggler come through. We need to have impromptu bands. And one of the other leaders said, you're mad. This is not what your garden is for. Your garden is supposed to be a place of peace and serenity, not a carnival.
Listen, buddy, we thought you'd plant some flowers and get on with it. So, yeah, I think the general consensus with Olmsted was that he was a bit mad.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
But he's the one that's buried in Chicago.
Mm.
He's one of the graves you could see.
Hmm.
So I thought that was kind of interesting.
See, he's another character that if they made an adaption, unfortunately, he'd have to be cut.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, for definitely in a movie. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's unfortunate.
Well, I think even in a TV show, because at some point, where do we inject a character that stops the plot from moving? And I feel like he's definitely one of
them. Fair enough.
Yes, I think he was interesting. In fact, I've been to the Biltmore Estate, which he helped design.
Yeah.
And he helped design, they have, I don't know how many acres, but it's a huge, huge, it's like the world's largest private backyard, in a sense, that he helped design. And the guy was, for all intents and purposes, a genius. Mm-hmm. And if you read up more on him, he did a lot of things before he became a landscape architect. He was a writer for magazines on travel. That's really one of the only things I remember about him. But unfortunately, because there's so little involvement within the major players of the story, he'd unfortunately probably get cut.
That's true. He'd be a guy in a room at one point in time who would yell something about a plant.
Well, now, if you are a fan, and I'm going to go off on a little tangent here, but I think I'm going to be able to bring it back for us. If you're a fan of comic books, you can watch comic book movies and you'll see throwaway characters and you'll be able to say, well, that's not a throwaway character. That, like the X-Men movies. You see Jubilee, you see Hank McCoy very early on. And they're in it for 30 seconds, but that little snippet makes a huge difference to the people who really know. That's the kind of snippet that you're going to look at and you're going to go,
yeah.
That's it. So Olmsted could be in there. He could be in there for 5 minutes. He could be a scene where some of the other architects are arguing with him, and that can be a scene that's going to not only give you a little factual accuracy, but also give you character development on some of the major players. Mm-hmm. And I think that's exactly the kind of thing that I would like to see, and I do see it in superhero movies, and I'm kind of a little miffed that I'm not seeing it in these new Star Wars movies. But at the same time, I agree with you. That whole plot arc of how important the flowers are would probably be a little too boring to make into a series arc on its own in a show, right? But there's no reason you need to cut him out completely. I think you just need to give him the appropriate amount of screen time, which I think would probably be somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 to 5 minutes.
Probably. I would hope for that.
Yeah.
But I think that's why I'm frequently disappointed in adaptations of books that I like.
Books, yes.
Because I don't get those little snippets that I'm looking for.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
As a general rule. But I would give DiCaprio, specifically channeling him from Django Unchained, I would give him a fair shake at being Holmes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let me quote the book again, and I'm going to bring this back to some of our favorite actors, of course, Kevin Spacey, as well as
Leonardo
DiCaprio. All right, we're talking about Geyer here. Geyer found Holmes to be smooth and glib, a social chameleon. Holmes is greatly given to lying on a sort of florid ornamentation on all his stories and decorated with flamboyant draperies intended by him to strengthen the plausibility of his statements. And as soon as I read that, I thought, oh, he's talking about Kaiser Soze.
Yeah. Wow. I didn't even think of that.
That's funny.
I did.
So you think that Holmes looked around a room as he was telling a story and just found random objects to put in them?
It was made in China.
Yeah. Well, I don't know where Holmes got his inspiration. However,
tripping over a silk scarf.
I like, but I thought it was fascinating that after Holmes was captured, he was just so blasé about the entire thing. Like, he's sitting in jail and
is one of the most tense moments of the book where
they found the bodies and they were trying to stop the newspaper before Holmes got his morning news, and they're like
tense
racing.
For who, you I mean, know?
Yeah, right.
And he's just sitting there casually reading his paper.
Tense for the reader, I think.
Precisely.
But you know, in real life, if he really was that way, like, well, you know, they got me.
Yeah. What took you so long?
Yeah.
It was fun while it lasted.
How unfortunate that they found those bodies that Minnie Williams killed. I mean, geez, that chick, right?
Would they never suspect my mother-in-law? I mean, she screamed for hours in that room, disturbing everyone.
I think we're far enough removed that I can kind of laugh at Holmes at this point.
Oh, without a doubt.
You mean out of respect if
the world can accept springtime for Hitler.
Exactly.
I think they can accept us laughing at Holmes.
Well, it's interesting how you deal with absolute monstrosity in the face of people, right? We all have at least had an encounter with someone who makes our skin crawl, or we have.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you wonder if the people who met Holmes, other than the descriptions Larson gives us as in the book, did they get that feeling from him?
Well, as I was reading, I think there was only one that I can specifically recall. One witness to this that was like, no, that guy's a creep.
Yeah.
And it was, he had just murdered Julia, the one
mm-hmm.
that he stole her from her husband, got her pregnant, and suggested that he perform a backroom abortion on Christmas Eve. Like, this guy...
That's normally do.
Right. Hey, it's Christmas Eve. Let's go, you know, take care of this. And then I'll marry you. And it was, there was a couple that lived in his building at that time. And it was the wife of the couple who was like, where's Julia? And why are you carrying that big chest dripping blood down the stairs? Like, how is she the only one that's kind of...
I don't recall exactly, but wasn't there in the group that confronted him about insurance fraud?
Yeah.
Wasn't there one guy who was a holdout? Or am I making that up?
No, I think you're right.
I don't recall exactly.
I think
exactly.
There was.
And it seems like there's always one guy who's just kind of like, well, I don't know. And everybody else drowns him out and says, nah, he's fine.
Nah. Just see how charming he was.
Mm-hmm.
He's so charming.
Mm-hmm.
He'll be fine.
He's a nice guy.
I think there was that one guy when he was building the castle, one of the people who worked at the castle, Holmes approached him and said, hey, you want to make $100?
Oh,
just
yeah.
Drop this big sack of bricks on that guy's head.
Wouldn't that be so easy to do?
It'd be very easy, wouldn't it?
The guy was like...
And he wasn't exactly saying, why don't you do it? He just kind of said, hey, you know, you could do it.
And I feel like that's a great scene that they could put... That's something that people would upload to YouTube after watching on a show.
Mm-hmm.
That's true.
Mm-hmm.
Because imagine... Yeah. That reminds me so much. When I first heard that, I pictured, I played it out, and I was thinking it's that scene from No Country for Old Men at the gas station. And he flips the coin, and he doesn't show it, and he doesn't look at it himself, and he's like, call it. And the guy, the gas station owner, he was like, I need to know what we're betting on. That reluctance, because... Immediately, as an audience member, you know that everyone in that situation knows exactly what the bet is for.
Right.
Hmm.
But I need you to say it out loud.
Yeah, and I need you to prove my point, my philosophy. And it's insanity like that. And in a great way, we haven't talked about this, the book deals with various aspects of insanity.
Yeah.
Like, H.H. Holmes just generalized insatiable hunger to murder people and
design
a castle to his grandeur, to his genius, and I'm air quoting here, his genius to himself, or the genius, the insanity to fight for a world's fair, you know, using essentially a newspaper war, or even the insanity of Prendergast, who murdered a mayor.
Mm-hmm.
Because he thought he'd be appointed to city council because he really mailed out a lot of postcards. Guys. Like, a lot. Okay, like, I wrote a lot of postcards.
It was the stress of it. And that, and again, that, you know, it, I don't remember if this detail was brought up in the book about Prendergast's childhood. and how he fell and suffered a really bad head injury as a child.
I think it may have been.
Yeah, they talked about that.
That doesn't sound unfamiliar.
Right? So you wonder if part of his insanity was partly based in his childhood on an accident.
Hmm.
So in a pseudo, and this is going to be really crazy, this is my insanity here, in a pseudo quantum physics type of way, the guy, had he taken the offer for the money and dropped the bricks, what if he dropped the bricks on Prendergast's head as a child? And in a non-linear timeline way, set up the assassination of Carter Harrison. Anyway.
That's all I have to think about.
There's some historical fiction for you.
There you go.
But speaking of characters, even we didn't even mention like Carter Henry Harrison, the mayor, who was murdered by Prendergast.
Mm-hmm.
And Larson does such a great job of painting him as a complete character.
Completely ignored Prendergast.
Well, because he didn't have time for that.
Well, he had no idea who he was.
He was too busy, like, riding his mule around town and whatnot.
Yeah.
I don't care about your postcards, boy. I got stuff to do today.
I have a city to run. I'll catch you later, boy.
Yeah.
But the idea that you, just because you contribute, and the mayor would never have in any reality have any idea who you are by mailing out postcards. Because they're anonymous.
Right.
You don't have a return address, right?
I would think.
So how would people know who he was? How would the mayor know that? And then in what universe would you assume you would be granted a corporate counsel position?
I mean, Pendergast universe, obviously. But I wonder how much of the personalities of these people and all of the characters in the book, all of the people mentioned, are conscripts of Larson's, as opposed to, like, was everyone completely oblivious to what Holmes was doing? You know, were there more people that were a little suspicious about his motives and what exactly he was doing in this murder castle, and did the builder really think he was making a kiln for firing pottery? Is that what he claimed it was?
Yeah, it was. It's kind of funny how we call it the murder castle today, and we say it as if like it was a known fact back then.
Yeah,
fair enough. But even the description Larson gives is like, when you picture it, there's this gleaming white city over here to the left, and then oh yeah, by the way, here's this like black three-story, no window, like dark, horrific block long building here.
They're called video gamers, Sarah. They said.
I don't know. Was no one suspicious at this point, though?
I
think a lot of people had suspicions, but what made Holmes so good at what he did was he had a way of making sure that nobody got so suspicious that they would get the gumption to do something about it.
Or, yeah, he would kind of disappear when people did get...
Mm-hmm. And he also, with fake names and identities, he was able to put off a lot of the more serious inquiries, like calling back to his creditors, and then having somebody come in and work on... And that was part of the game, is I think he liked teasing it, because I think he knew that guy who came in to look at his kiln. It's not getting hot enough. Can you come and take a look at this?
He was like, how hot do you need this to be?
He knew that he was pushing it there. But that was the game to him. That's what he wanted to play. He wanted to live it close to the edge.
That's true. And one of my favorite fun facts from the book was that he actually started calling himself Holmes after Sherlock Holmes after he read the books.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely insane. Absolutely crazy.
I go, hey, I can be smart like that. And
I mean, people cosplay, but that's taking it to another level.
Well, you know.
And again, it was this idea that he was some sort of unsung, unheard of genius.
Yeah. And I mean, he did have game, though.
Building the castle, firing and hiring people. And I think even that was pushing people, was trying to be like, how many are going to ask questions? How are they all going to deduce it's me? How am I going to string all these people along?
And the fact is, the sheer number of people he had involved in his enterprises.
Right, impressive. But I also kind of question how many people put it all together. It was a tough time living in back then. It really was.
Really
stopped and thought about this weird-ass guy who just fired them. they were like, time to go get another job.
Right. Well, whatever. I hear we can go dig a moat for the pygmies to boat around in at the World's Fair next door.
This was... I can see why somebody would want to write about this period of time, because it seemed like everybody was losing their minds.
A little bit. And I wonder, well, maybe that's just a juxtaposition to the way we behave today and what... We're used to such instantaneous information. And...
Oh, no. What's that say about us?
Yeah, right. They didn't have the online and the Twitter back then, so... It's pretty pretty impressive how they communicated, you know.
Oh. But even the way he pulled the wool over the mother at the end, he took one of her children and murdered it, right? And then was like, hey, why don't you give me your other three? No big deal. I'll just, go find that other kid with these three. And she agrees to it.
I can't fathom.
No, it's so staggering to me. As a parent, if
my boss, Rich, were to come and say, hey, let me take Glenn and Henry for a couple of days. I mean, I love this guy. He's a great guy.
Right.
But as soon as you ask for that, I'm, what? No, that's okay. I think we're all right.
We're good. We got the kids. Thanks, though. That's nice. And by the way, we're moving tomorrow and quitting the job.
Sorry. I gave my 2 weeks notice 2 days ago.
Yeah, you're kind of creeping me out right now. But I guess it is a question of, was it just... the times? You trusted people?
Hard to say. I'm sure it was a combination of that. And then the slower methods of communication?
Yeah. I think it's easier to hide in the shadows back then.
Yeah. And then probably the fact that this guy was just charming. I mean, you could just trust him. Well, coming up on close to an hour, so I'm going to go ahead and ask everybody if they have any last thoughts about The Devil in the White City, that we can pass those around now.
Well, one of my questions was, do you think that Holmes was the Devil in the White City?
Mm-hmm.
Or do you think the Devil in the White City is sort of talking about the book as a whole? Like, we had the White City, but it was built on
Holmes might not be the devil, but the devil and his influence causing fires, causing negligence so that people don't notice these fires, causing the balloon accident.
Right, or the...
there were a few other bad things that happened.
Wow.
Lost their cool in the Ferris wheel and tried to break down the door until they basically parakeeted him by putting a shirt over his face. Is that...
Woman's skirt.
Yeah. And then everyone was scandalized that she was showing her skirt. Or not wearing a skirt.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was my... Do you think
Holmes, Prendergast.
Do you think... Is Prendergast... Yeah. Did that sequence of events that allowed Prendergast to enter...
Mm-hmm. Just...
Harrison... Or, Harrison's home and shoot
mm-hmm.
him.
Mm-hmm. But you interesting, though, you mentioned all these bad things that happen, and then he goes... Larson goes through a big point towards the end of the book to talk about how very little security had to do, considering how many people were at the...
Yeah.
Fair. A lot of pickpocketing, some drunken brawls, but outside of that, nothing, really. That's a good point. What is the devil? Is Holmes the devil? Or is Holmes one of the devil's playthings?
Is the devil in the details in all of these white cities that we have throughout the novel?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that makes it interesting now, saying that if the very ground that the city was built on is rotten.
Hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that was a big element early
everything
on.
Everything else, yeah.
Did Figuring out how you can build on it.
Build on quicksand, mm-hmm. basically.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it kind of just goes back and makes everything seem, with the World's Fair, like a fool's errand.
Hmm. Well, here's a question. What would Holmes have done had the World's Fair been given to a different city? Had Washington or New York or even St. Louis got it? Would he have followed that?
That's a good question.
Would he have gone where
it
was?
Do you think the appeal was Chicago, or was the appeal the fair for him?
Off the cuff, I think he would have gone wherever the fair was. I think he saw the fair as an opportunity. I think it really depends on what the situation was like. I mean, if he could have done the same kind of thing, he probably would have, or possibly something even better in his mind.
That's very interesting, actually.
A four-story motor car, though.
Perhaps. It has been 10 years since I have read this book, and I still remember it, and I still like it, and I will still talk about it. So I actually should read it again.
Amen.
Yeah, I read it a long time ago and then reread it right before, and I was glad I did.
Yeah. See, I read it for the first... I started it on... My opening note is, it's a very romantic Valentine read, because I started it February 13th. So. It's so sweet of me to read a murder book for Valentine's Day.
Sounds perfect.
It is perfect.
That's kind of also talking about The Devil in the White City, or what it was, is that's kind of Larson's theme. I was reading that his World War II book, In the Garden of Beasts.
Mm-hmm.
And that one, it's the same kind of structure. It's about an American diplomat in pre-World War II, but still Nazi Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And how the corruption is slowly eating away at what was Berlin.
Hmm.
And how there was this palpable sense of just hatred and fear going on.
What is The Devil in the White City?
What are his themes? What was his message at the end of the day? Once you put the book down, what did we all feel?
I think you feel hope, because you get the dogged detective at the end who follows this case and goes to hotel after hotel after hotel, in city after city after city, to finally get enough information to nail this guy. Mm-hmm. But then the final end is Holmes is hung, and he has this, like, ludicrous instructions for his lawyer, and they're carried out, where he's, like, encased in 7 layers of concrete and put under slabs and over slabs so that no one can ever exhume his body.
Hmm. Well, for me, Holmes was not the focus. Holmes was, like, the spice in the story. So my takeaway has got to be, here you have a sense of, not national, but civic pride that inspires just an absolute madcap farce of a business enterprise that absolutely churns out an incredible experience, great stories, great historical significance, with outside of the devilish influences, a couple of fires, a couple of accidents, a couple of madmen, a legacy that has lasted for, what are we going on, 130 years now?
We do still have zippers.
Exactly. And now we have Disneyland and Busch Gardens and all of these things that I love. And there's city streets. You can walk down a city street at night and it's bright because we have electric lights. Mm. The influence is very positive going along. And then you can take that and you can juxtapose that with, so you've got this madman, but in the end, maybe he is just like the Joker. Maybe he just wanted to watch the world burn, but we stopped him. And now we're on the lookout. Well, maybe this is a bad thing. We stopped him and now we're on the lookout for more serial killers. And now we're seeing them everywhere we go. I don't know. It's hard to say. And of course, the estimates of him having killed hundreds of people, even though we've only been able to confirm couple dozen?
27, yeah. Something like that.
But the estimates go 10 times that.
Yeah, but right. They were his own estimates.
Why wouldn't you believe him?
But why would you? He lies about everything.
Well, I guess that's true, but I mean, it seems like if you're playing a game that you absolutely love, you don't lie about your score. Oh,
direct proof of 9 murders.
Okay.
So 9 that you can absolutely be like, yeah, he did that.
And but according rumors to his of up descendant, to 200. He was also Jack the Ripper.
Huh? Mm-hmm.
But Jack the Ripper only had...
4?
Only.
5?
5.
5 victims. But again, you know,
who knows?
That's 13 then, right?
Yeah. If you add it up.
But his estimate...
I'm not buying into that, though.
But there was a serial killer, Henry Lucas, who lied about the number of victims he had. And in fact, that's proven. That's a proven fact that he lied about that.
Hmm.
He was the one that was trying to top someone else's, though, right?
Right. But the thing is we didn't have widespread mass media like we do now.
Correct.
In Holmes's time. So the point is, I agree that he was probably giving you his best estimate. How many times would he have gotten drunk and just killed someone? How many times would he If he did,
how many times did he just drop a rock on someone's head and walk away?
Exactly. How many times did he trip somebody going into a cart or in front of a horse-drawn carriage that was going down the street? How many times did he push somebody in front of a train? Or just kill a homeless person? Or
could have been.
You wonder. And plus, we don't have there's no accurate death record for that time. There's no missing persons database.
Yep.
Yeah, one of the other things that stood out was with one of the murders, he had the woman address her own wedding cards beforehand. And then murdered her. And then sent out these wedding announcements that said she was married to one of his aliases, and they were written in her handwriting. They're like, I mean, obviously she wrote this. It's her. Yeah, who knows?
I mean, you got to think, though, this is top-shelf detective work, though, with this guy, though, back then.
Of course.
With Guyer,
Absolute top-shelf detective work. And I'm not saying that sarcastically. I'm saying that guy's a hero.
Oh, yeah.
By estimates, how many people did he save? How many lives did he help? Keep going. You think about that. Had Holmes not been caught.
Who is the guy in Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
Bob Hoskins
could be Guyer.
Eddie Valiant.
Eddie Valiant.
You know he died, though.
Yeah, I do. Plus, that was 20 years ago. But if we could get somebody like that, maybe...
Nick Nolte?
Possibly.
Maybe.
Gary Oldman.
Yes, yeah. Gary Oldman.
Okay.
Could be good.
The crazy part is again, like, it... Both these men in this game that they played, and what's ironic to me about this whole thing is that Holmes very naturally wanted his Moriarty.
Right.
Right?
But he didn't find Moriarty until, like, Holmes was already arrested when Guyer took up the search.
Exactly.
Right?
So for me, it was at some point, it was about he was searching for something he was never smart enough to know how to get. Like, he'd do these things like, oh, go scream in that, or keep turning the kiln's not hot enough, you know? Like, how hot do you want this to be? He'd push that in order to try and get people to question who he was, but he wasn't smart enough to understand that people just don't care. Like, there's not some secret cabal of people that gather at night talking about H.H. Holmes.
Which is probably what he wanted.
Madness was probably the devil in the White City, because every person in this book was absolutely bonkers.
That's probably the truth. Not crazy characters were crazy.
You're right. Yeah. They were crazy in their own way. They more.
Olmsted had crazy tendencies. Carter Henry Harrison was crazy.
The architects
were crazy.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And was it true?
Maybe Madness is the devil. Like that. I'm going to run with it.
I like that theme.
Madness is the devil, because you even said that the sinking ground, it's rotted ground.
Right, like they had to learn completely new... This is where the skyscraper was birthed from, correct?
Yeah.
Because they learned new ways to build.
And it's fascinating to think that perhaps, and it's even sort of suggested now that I think about it more and more since you brought up the rotted ground. Even sort of suggested by Larson in the book that perhaps madness is sometimes built into a place and you shouldn't be there.
I think he definitely suggested that pretty heavily when discussing the World Fair location.
Right.
And even there was a quote from Holmes. He says, "I was born with the devil in me. I couldn't help the fact that I was a murderer no more than the poet can help the inspiration to sing."
If he was born with the devil in him, that's his version of the devil. So then the devil was already there when they built the right city.
Was that ground?
The devil?
Was the devil already there when they chose that site as the site of the white city? Columbian Exposition?
Madness and rotting wood. Or rotting land.
Right.
Land. I think my final thing to wrap up, though, is Larson, I think, is probably one of the most talented nonfiction writers we have today.
I really have not talked to a single person that read this book and didn't like it. And everyone that I've mentioned it to, many, many, many of my reader and non-reader friends have read it, and everyone says, yeah, that was excellent.
Mm-hmm. Or they've heard of it.
At the very least.
Like, this was a big book when it first came out, wasn't it?
I don't know.
I mean, I just heard about it, and if it passes my radar, it's got to be at least passingly big.
Right. But that's
It doesn't even cross 4 stars on Goodreads, which I thought was shocking.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like 3.98 or 3.89, pardon me. But
maybe they never finished the book.
I suppose not.
You didn't realize how good it got in the end there.
All right, so that's The Devil in the White City. So right now I want to take a minute to round table. Give me your 5-star review of Devil in the White City, and then tell me what else you've been reading, any other recommendations, or anything else you want to share. Well, we're running a little long on time, so try and keep it as quick as possible. Daniel, I'll start with you.
Yeah, sure. Devil in the White City by Eric Larson. I'd give it 4.5 stars. It's gripping. It's symbolic. It's historical. Put a cliche method, you won't be able to put it down. It is a white knuckle thrill ride from start to finish, even about the most mundane objects, such as vote counts or how to fight for a newspaper or an architect site. It's absolutely stunning how enthralled you are as a reader in this book. 4.5 stars. The only thing that keeps it from being a solid 5 was there were points in time that I had to put it down because of how dense it was. So it's easily digestible, but there's too much to eat.
Yeah. It got a little thick.
There you go, 4.5 stars.
Yeah. Any other book recommendations? What else you've been reading lately? Any other interests?
Yeah, absolutely. By Gaslight, which is a historical fiction novel by Stephen Price. It's a really good mystery novel. It's about William Pinkerton, who's the son of the man who founded the Pinkerton Agency in the U.S. Been reading that, and I've also gotten into a true crime kick. I've got a book by Jeffrey Toobin, who wrote the book that the miniseries The People versus O.J. Simpson was based on.
Oh, interesting.
And this one, the book I'm reading, is called American Heiress: The Wild Saga of the Kidnapping, Crimes, and Trial of Patty Hearst.
Oh,
and it's very, very good. Yeah. And it does not shy away from condemning her for a majority of her actions. Which spits in the face of her alibi and her story.
How about you, sir?
Devil in the White City is definitely a 4.5 for me. Reserved only from 5 because I usually like to give things a little time before I bump them up to a 5. I want to see if I still feel as strongly as I do currently in about a year or so. But I thought it was fantastic. A little thick in parts, but for the most part, I think Larson did a fantastic job of weaving the stories together and really painting good characters. I'm reading some Mary Roach right now in anticipation of a future podcast. I just finished Packing for Mars, and I'm in the middle of Spook, I think. Yeah, Spook. And I also have some Anne Rice here on the shelf.
Lou Anne Rice.
Lou Anne Rice? Is that the one?
Are they about vampires? Then you have Lou Anne Rice.
No, I'm misquoting the author.
Well, it's not Anne Rice. If it's not about Lestat and Louis,
it's not
Anne Rice.
It's not. The Green River Killer. The one that worked with Ted Bundy, the Ted Bundy book.
I don't know.
Anne Rule.
Okay. Wait, is Lauren she the one who married a serial killer?
Did she?
There's a crime author who she had physical relationships with 2 serial killers. She was married to one, and then she dated another one. Before it came out, they were serial killers. Not well, she knew, you know.
Yeah.
I know Anne Rule worked with Ted Bundy and had no idea because he was so charming.
Very Holmesian.
Okay.
I have that. And I have the Larson book about the Lusitania on the shelf, too. So that's hopefully we'll knock some out over the Dead Wake is the Lusitania book.
Aaron, how about yourself?
I give it a 5. I am one of the non-reader friends who happened to...
You are one of my non-reader friends who recommended it.
Yeah, you know. I have trouble being entertained sometimes. And like I said, I don't wasn't a big history fan. And the entertainment factor and learning about what happened in history actually led to me enjoying history even more, to the point where, you know, I live in Michigan, so... I go around and I see more historical things around here because there's a lot of history in this area that I probably wouldn't have gone to look at or sought out before. I went back to my favorite author, who's Stephen King, so I spent a lot of time listening to his novels on Audible, and the Dark Tower series is supposed to come out soon, which is my favorite right up there with The Stand. So,
oh, that's right. They're doing the movies, right?
Yeah, the miniseries, I think. Yeah, so I had to, it's been, you know, since mid-1990s since I've actually read the series. I started it. I'm aging myself now. But, so I went back to that. So that's what I'm doing.
I tried so hard with The Dark Tower.
Oh, I love it.
For me. I know. Yeah. Maybe I'll try it again.
You have to have that dark side, you know?
Oh, like I don't. What'd you think, Daddy?
I thought that Devil in the White City was fantastic. Loved every moment of it. I'd give it 4.5 stars easily.
Yeah.
And I love it for all the same reasons that's already been mentioned, so I won't go into all of that. I would recommend, if you liked this one, I would recommend The Ghost Map by Steven Johnson. It's written in a very similar way. Hmm. It's about cholera epidemic in London, Victorian London. I'm not sure about the time frame, but you know, before they had running water and all that kind of stuff. Fascinating. I read that one about the same time as I read Devil in the White City, and it's written in a similar fashion, and I enjoyed it very much. I also have been thinking about picking up Stephen King. I've actually never read The Stand, so I was thinking about picking that one up.
I was thinking about that, too.
Mm-hmm. We, of course, did a podcast episode on Salem's Lot.
We did, and I enjoyed it more than I thought I would.
Mm-hmm. And I, in general, like Stephen King. I was also thinking about rereading it. But other than that, I've just been reading podcast books and listening to other podcasts.
And what podcasts are you listening to? Any good shout-outs?
Actually, I've been, Forward Thinking's no longer on the air, but I'm going back and listening to a bunch of the episodes I didn't listen to.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the only thing I'd mention right off the top of my head.
Do we have suggestions for another book?
Well, the next book we're going to be recording, next episode we'll be recording, will be Mary Roach for Packing for Mars and Spook. Mm-hmm. Following that, we should be doing V.C. Williams?
V.C.
Andrews.
V.C. Andrews.
Flowers in the Attic.
Did you read that back in middle school, Aaron?
Yes, you didn't hear me because I was on mute. I went, ooh.
Russ is reading it, which I love. But I haven't read it since like middle school, so I need to...
I think I'd feel uncomfortable talking about parts of it.
I think that book's banned now in school.
It should be.
I think it is banned. I think it's banned from being in school because I don't. Yeah. I remember hearing about it and how bad it was. And...
If Harry Potter's banned, this should be banned. Oh, that's all I have to say.
I have it. So I have a copy out from the library right now, and I just tried to renew my checkout, and there are holds on it. Like, who in their right mind is putting a hold outside of me?
They got to. They want their fix.
And I imagine there's only one copy in all of Montgomery County.
There were like 8.
Yeah.
But there are a million people here.
All the mid-30-year-olds are like, oh, I have to relive this book.
I'll have to give that a read because I've heard about it but never read it.
Oh, it's... I'm sort of looking forward to reading it as an adult and then sort of just horrified.
Okay, so we can look forward to an episode on Flowers in the Attic in the near future. But in the meantime, thank you everyone for joining us for Devil in the White City. I hope you enjoyed it, and we'll see you next time. A Novel Podcast is looking to produce more episodes, and we want you to join us. If you like reading novels and then talking about them, then you're a perfect candidate. We record remotely, so your location on Earth isn't a consideration, and no prior experience is necessary. Send us an email or a tweet, and let us know what books you'd like to discuss. A Novel Podcast @gmail.com or @A Novel Podcast. Look forward to hearing from you.